Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're really wrestling with a topic that is highly complex.
And deeply personal.
Exactly. And it's one that is increasingly landing UK employers in court. How to manage the collision between protected characteristics
Specifically, gender reassignment and gender critical belief.
and that balancing act just got a whole lot harder following the UK Supreme Court's ruling in For Women Scotland, which defined sex in the Equality Act 2010 as, well, biological sex.
That FWS ruling was a moment of legal clarity on one word, sex. But for organizations just trying to run a workplace, it created a practical legal fog.
Right.
So our mission today really is to cut right through that fog. We've got two crucial employment tribunals, Kelly v. Leonardo UK Limited and Peggy v. Fife Health Board.
And these really show us what happens when these protected rights clash in the break room, in the changing room.
Absolutely. We're going to pinpoint exactly where the employers went wrong and, critically, how organizations can move forward to uphold dignity, privacy, and legal compliance all at the same time.
And I think it's essential context we need to lay down immediately. Despite that FWS ruling, trans people remain firmly protected under the gender reassignment characteristic in the Equality Act.
Yes, they are absolutely protected against discrimination and harassment.
So that hasn't changed.
No, not at all. The legal certainty that the FWS ruling kind of failed to provide means that organizations have to fall back on the core protection mechanism in the Act.
Which is.
Well, any policy that results in exclusion or different treatment, it has to meet a very high legal bar. And that bar is being a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim.
That's the key phrase, isn't it? Proportionate means.
It's everything. That principle of proportionality is the filter every single policy has to pass, and it's the single greatest point of failure for employers we see in these cases.
Okay, let's unpack this then with our first case study, Kelly v. Leonardo UK Limited. This one set a really critical baseline for how policies are interpreted, didn't it?
It did. It all centered around a female employee, MK, who held a gender-critical belief.
And she challenged her employer's internal policy regarding access to facilities.
That's right. MK challenged the company's internal policy, what the law calls a PCP, a provision, criterion, or practice.
And this PCP, what did it say?
It essentially stated that staff who assert a gender identity different from their biological sex could use the supposedly single-sex toilets that align with their affirmed gender.
So the policy was intended to support the inclusion of trans employees. But MK, whose gender-critical belief is protected, she argued this fundamentally changed the female toilets into mixed-sex facilities.
Exactly. Her claim was that this violated her dignity and created a degrading and intimidating environment because of her belief. So she claimed harassment and direct discrimination.
And this is where the legal reasoning gets sort of quite nuanced.
It really is.
Yeah.
MK's belief that biological sex is immutable and therefore trans women shouldn't use female facilities, that belief is protected. But the tribunal ruled that her claims of harassment and discrimination actually failed.
Wait, that seems like a tough hurdle to clear. If someone genuinely feels their dignity is violated, how can a tribunal objectively declare that feeling unreasonable? Isn't that undermining the whole concept of harassment?
That's a crucial distinction, you know. Harassment has two parts. There's a subjective element, did the person feel violated?
Okay.
And an objective element, was it reasonable for the employer's policy to have that effect? And here, the tribunal concluded it was not reasonable for the policy to have created a degrading environment for Emma K.
Why did they come down on that side? What were the specific facts they highlighted?
Context and practical impact were everything. They noted three critical things. First, the employer had alternative single occupancy toilets available to her.
So a private, non-gendered option.
Precisely. If she felt uncomfortable, she had another option. Second, the tribunal noted she had actually shared the facility with trans women before without any complaint.
Oh, that's interesting.
And third, and this was maybe the most damning part, they found the policy, in real terms, had no practical effect on her. Her subjective feeling of violation, while they acknowledged it, it wasn't enough because the employer's policy was objectively reasonable given all those mitigating factors.
So the message from Kelly is that if an employer provides reasonable alternatives, it can significantly weaken a claim that an inclusive policy creates a degrading environment.
Yes, it sets a baseline. It prioritizes practical solutions over, say, a claimant's theoretical distress. The employer's policy was upheld because its implementation showed proportionality. They considered all their staff.
Okay, now let's pivot to the Peggy v5 Health Board case. If Kelly was about policy, Peggy was about direct personal conflict that just spiraled.
It really did. This is a perfect example of what happens when theory meets the harsh reality of the workplace. It involved a nurse with gender-critical beliefs and a trans woman doctor, R2, over the use of a female changing room.
So let's start with employer wrong number one, the access failure. This goes right back to that proportionality test you mentioned.
It does. NHS Fife gave the doctor, R2, permission to use the female changing room. But the tribunal concluded that for a specific 7-month period, that permission was actually unlawful.
Unlawful? Why?
Because when the claimant first complained, the employer completely failed the less intrusive measure test.
Where the tribunal talks about less intrusive measures, what does that actually look like in a hospital? Are we talking about changing rotas, or were there other facilities they just didn't offer?
It could be both. The proportionality test requires an employer to prove they considered the option with the least negative impact on everyone involved.
Right.
So maybe that's finding an alternative private changing area for R2. Maybe it's staggered rotas. But by just permitting continued access without even exploring those alternatives, NHS 5 put an unjustifiable detriment on the gender-critical staff member.
They jumped to the easiest solution for them, not the least impactful one for everyone.
Exactly. They failed the test.
So NHS Fife was found to have discriminated against the nurse. But here's where it gets even more complicated, because the nurse herself also engaged in conduct that was deemed discriminatory.
And this is the definitive takeaway for workplace behavior.
Mm-hmm.
The claimant's belief is protected. No one disputes that.
But
she chose to directly confront R2 in the changing room. She told her, "You are not a woman and could not be in there." And then she referenced the high-profile case of Isla Bryson, a convicted sex offender.
Wow. So that direct confrontational use of her belief crossed a line. It went from protected expression to harassment related to gender reassignment.
That's it. Perfectly put. The tribunal found her actions violated R2's dignity and created an intimidating, hostile environment. You have a right to your belief. You do not have a right to use that belief to misgender or demean a colleague.
And the employer's duty to prevent harassment trumps the right to manifest a belief in an aggressive way.
Yes. And there was a third major mistake by NHS Fife. It wasn't about access or confrontation. It was about basic HR management, the disciplinary process itself.
This detail often gets missed, doesn't it? It's not just the big legal issue. It's the human cost of being left in limbo.
Absolutely. They suspended the claimant, which is a detriment, for an unreasonable length of time. The tribunal found the employer failed to give any real justification for the long delay in the investigation.
So let me just pause there. This tells us the employer didn't just lose on the complexity of identity law. They lost on basic HR competence. Is that a fair assessment?
It's absolutely fair. Lengthy, unjustified disciplinary delays can be a legal issue in their own right, as detriment or victimization, regardless of the conflict that started it.
So even if you're facing a complex issue, the clock is still ticking on your internal processes.
Yes. Peggy shows that if you fail to move with due speed, you create an entirely new, actionable legal risk for yourself.
Okay, that gives us the full picture from both cases. So what does this massive stack of, well, frankly, contradictory findings mean for organizations trying to prevent this kind of workplace toxicity?
I think the synthesis is incredibly instructive. First, regarding protected rights, HR leaders have to recognize that you don't have to pick a side legally. You have to uphold the law for all protected groups.
So both gender-critical belief and gender reassignment are protected.
Yes. The legal boundary is drawn around behavior. Holding a belief is lawful. Using that belief to exclude, misgender, or demean others in the workplace is not.
That sounds simple on paper, but I imagine it's incredibly difficult in daily practice. How does an employer monitor that line without, you know, appearing to police thought?
It requires a huge cultural shift towards conduct expectations. Training has to focus on impact, not intent. An employer has to be able to say, you're free to believe what you wish, but calling a colleague not a woman in a professional setting, that creates a hostile environment. And we have a duty to protect that colleague from harassment.
You focus on the action, not the belief.
The impactful action. That is your legal defense.
Okay, takeaway number two, the proportionality imperative. How robustly must an organization document its justification for single-sex spaces now?
The documentation needs to be airtight. A blanket exclusion of trans people is only lawful if it is proportionate, justified, and crucially individualized.
So a generalized discomfort among some staff is not a lawful basis for exclusion.
Not at all. You have to demonstrate genuine justification based on evidence safeguarding risks, privacy needs that just cannot be met by less intrusive means. If you can't prove you looked for that least intrusive measure, you fail the test, just like NHS Fife did.
And practically speaking, the Kelly case gave us a huge clue for how to mitigate this. What's the consensus solution for facilities?
The best practice is clear. Prioritize providing private, unisex, or single-user facilities and make them available to everyone.
Because that removes the point of friction entirely.
It does. It offers dignity and privacy to anyone who needs it, whether that's due to a disability, religion, gender identity, or just personal comfort. You solve the conflict by designing it out.
And a major practical point we have to emphasize, what should employers absolutely never do?
They must never ask for ID or medical proof to police access to facilities.
Why not?
Well, you risk breaching UK GDPR on sensitive personal data. And more seriously, you risk breaching Section 22 of the Gender Recognition Act. Unlawfully disclosing someone's GRC status is a criminal offense. You just have to presume honesty and prioritize privacy.
The moment you start demanding documents at the bathroom door, you're in very serious legal trouble.
Very serious. Criminal trouble.
Okay, finally, what if an organization has to update its policies now, post-FWS? How do they communicate that pivot without causing internal anxiety or looking like they're backtracking?
They have to own the shift with clarity and accountability. The communication should be open. Something like, we made previous decisions based on the best guidance at the time. The law has evolved. We're updating our policies now to ensure compliance with the Equality Act for all protected characteristics. Our commitment to dignity and fairness hasn't changed.
So you frame it as a function of legal necessity, not an indictment of past behavior. So the overall lesson here is that the ambiguity from the highest court has forced organizations to be perfectly clear, documented, and evidence-led. The risk isn't just a policy debate. It's the internal procedural failures. It's failing the proportionality test, mishandling conflict, and those damaging delays.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we have to underscore the legal uncertainty that still remains. The FWS Supreme Court decision was, rightly criticized for defining sex without conducting a full human rights analysis.
Specifically, how it lines up with the European Convention on Human Rights.
Precisely. That lack of comprehensive analysis leaves a massive legal gap.
Which raises an important question for you, the listener, to consider. The law now demands that employers draw these precise, evidence-led lines to balance biological definitions against dignity and inclusion. But when the highest courts fail to provide that complete clarity on human rights, who ultimately pays the price for that legal uncertainty?
The expense and the emotional toll of these tribunals, they fall on marginalized groups. Like trans people, who experience high rates of anxiety and compounded exclusion risks, especially if they also have a disability.
And that really is the true test of organizational culture moving forward. Managing the cost of these legal gaps, not just the cost of legal compliance.